wheelbarrow. And here's me hitting up the Guinness storehouse, a big bag of cans with the lads. I'm such an alcoholic. Maybe I'm secretly Irish. And don't you have a gay president now? I can't believe I even left and I was there 3 days. What the heck have the Irish got against Ireland? I said, you know we can't get abortions. I did not always feel I was Madison's favorite Irish person. I loved Edith so much, it seemed only sensible to worry about losing her. You could hardly stake that much in someone and not think every now and then of what you'd do without them. I analyzed the contingencies and concluded, nothing. On the couch or in my bed, I measured various scenarios in which Edith left me and decided my ensuing strategy would be none. Up and down the escalator, pacing my clammy classroom. If she ended it, I would end too. Sometimes this seemed fine and normal, and sometimes it made me grip whatever I was holding until my fingers hurt. When that happened, I messaged Julian. Edith did not exist in the space I shared with him, which let me compose myself again. I wrote, "Everyone has too many feelings. It's embarrassing." He agreed. Inside my quarantined dynamic with him, I was safe. He'd made me unhappy, but I'd be in a far deeper gradation of misery if Edith ever abandoned me. She gave me concomitant highs. Sometimes I felt I was hiding from those too, when I talked to Julian. Chapter 35. Li Hongzhang, a Chinese general of the late Qing dynasty, claimed not to understand why Europeans worshipped Christ. He didn't see how anyone could get behind a savior whose own life had been such a bust he'd ended up crucified, a painful death, and a degrading punishment besides. Miles told me the story. Later, I related it to Julian on the phone.
"He had a point, old Hongzhang," Julian said. "I doubt you'd catch Warren Buffett nailed to a cross."
"Is there anything you'd die for?" I said.
"I don't see what good that would do. Unless you're of the persuasion that lining all the bankers up against the wall would automatically make the world a better place, which you may well be."
"So what should Jesus have done?" I said, "since getting crucified is beta carry-on."
"Ideally, he'd have founded a startup."
During the call, I made herbal tea. The mug was initially too hot to hold. It was a long call. I knew because slowly I could touch more of my skin against the ceramic. I thought, this is an efficient way of tracking my personal correspondence. "By the way," I said, "I'm not fucking you when you're back."
"You really have been working on yourself," he said.
If Edith were there, I would have struggled to explain why we were laughing. I'd say, it's amusing when I tell Julian I might stop having sex with him, because then I'd have to live somewhere else and he knows I can't. And it's hysterical when he implies that me fucking him is a form of self-harm, because he's right. There would, in any case, be more pressing issues if I ever had to explain me and Julian to Edith. The following night, he messaged about Kat.
"Saw her at a party. Mostly fine. We talked about May's EU citizenship guarantee. She has this friend, Izzy, and she, Izzy, said something about me showing my face here. Don't know if Kat agrees. Talk soon, Jay."
I read it in the queue at the Cane Road Starbucks. Experimentally, I typed, "I feel like you take me for granted, and particularly that I'll still be here when you get back for granted. Which is not unamusing when A, I'm still not entirely sure you're not the guy in American Psycho, B, my girlfriend is 1, a literal goddess, and 2, almost certainly not that guy, and C, I admittedly can't quite stop talking to you, but I'm pretty sure it's just I'm so fucked up that I need a break from having feelings." When it came my turn to order coffee, I deleted the draft with an air of now having real business to attend to. I told Miles about Julian's take on the Li Hongzhang anecdote, and he said it was the same reception Julian had given the tale when Miles had first told him it. Clearly, Julian had feigned the same interest a parent would when their kid told them something they already knew.
or had forgotten the story since Miles last told it, in which case his reactions were entirely predictable since he'd had the same one twice. We sat on the roof terrace above Miles's apartment. He shared it with the building's other occupants, but today it was empty.
"I do appreciate your coming to see me," said Miles. "Have more wine. I've had a bit of a head start on you."
I wondered if most people's relationships with their father more closely resembled mine with my dad or mine with Miles. My entire verbal contact with Dad since moving to Hong Kong had been strings of,
"How are you getting on? Very good, very good. And how's work? Very good, very good. And is it hot?"
And then back over to Mam. We couldn't discuss politics because he'd say something awful about travellers or trans people, and Mam would look at me like, "Don't be hassling him." The only thing we had in common was DNA, which gave us limited mileage conversationally.
"I wanted to ask you about Julian," he said. "How do you think he's getting on in London?"
"Fine, I think. He likes his job."
"I'll never understand him."
"Me neither," I said. "He was asking after you." Julian had probably asked Miles about me too. I wondered what Miles might have told him. There surely wasn't much he could say except that I was doing fine, and it would, I reflected, be unreasonable of Julian to extrapolate from this that I now had a girlfriend called Edith. Lots of people were doing fine and had no such girlfriend. Miles said they planned to go to church some Sunday when Julian returned, and I was welcome to join. They were Anglican, Miles said. My childhood impression was that Protestants sang a lot and were either more or less literal about wafers, depending how you saw it. Julian and Miles both had thick necks and voices whose timbres suggested a certain vim of throat. They'd be an asset come hymn time. I told Miles about Mass in Ireland. My parents didn't believe in God and were Catholic to boot. I explained this wasn't contradictory, and was in fact the case for most Irish people. But Mam had made me go to the important services, because if you didn't, you'd never be Mary in the Nativity play. I was never Mary anyway. I fidgeted too much, and the Mother of God surely kept her hands still or gainfully occupied, not twiddling her ponytail. Clearly I had some potential as an actress, or I couldn't simultaneously be Edith's girlfriend and Julian's whatever the hell I was. Edith's girlfriend was honest about her feelings. Julian's whatever the hell she was did whatever the hell she did. It was like the riddle with two doors and two guards, one who told the truth and the other who lied. And I had a privilege rarely afforded to stage professionals. I could choose which was a character and which the real me. Could choose, as in no one else would choose for me, and couldn't choose, as in couldn't. Chapter 36. "We need to do something about the apartment," Edith said in late July. She began by leaving freesias and tulips in the hall with a note, "Put them in water or they'll die." I'd given her what I thought of as the spare key, though it was really Julian's. I wondered if Edith had taken this as a hint that I wanted her to reverse burgle me with Vanderbloom's summer selection. I had no idea how real couples worked. I put the bouquet in a vase I'd found in the cupboard, coated in dust so thick it felt like silt. Later, I rang Edith. "I put them in water," I said. "They're still dying." Next evening, the flowers were gone, and there were new ones I didn't recognize. The tag said, "Tango leucospermum, kangaroo paws, scabiosa pods, eucalyptus, and in-season assortment." I typed a message to Edith asking what the point was of being a banker's moll if a year into it I was this unfamiliar with bouquets, then remembered sending it would be, probably, the worst idea ever. I was a horrible person. I was living in one person's flat, fucking someone else without telling them, and regretted my behaviour primarily on the grounds that it meant I couldn't mock the first person with the second. But I had a mythologically beautiful girlfriend and a nice apartment to share with her. It seemed ungrateful to say anything that might reverse my luck. "I'm not keeping you in Vanderbloom's forever," Edith said. I'd complained the new flowers were dying too.
Come on, big spender, I said. Fine, she said. Take the Amex.
Like cross-pollination, our clothes went back and forth. Her dresses in my wardrobe and my jumpers in hers. I saw her loafers in the hall and thought that if Julian saw them, the gig would be up. Then I remembered he'd think they were mine. Really, it all could be. Anything on his credit card might be something I was buying for myself. If his friends saw us together, it would be harder to persuade them we were fucking than we weren't. I almost wished I were still in contact with Victoria so I could say, I have found a novel solution to the administrative challenges of cheating. But I hadn't seen her in over 2 months now, and Julian had been gone nearly 6. On the last day of July, I was in bed, willing myself to sleep, not sleeping, refreshing things on my phone, when a message came.
Just to let you know, work sending me back now. Flight next week. Logistics to sort, so might be hard to reach. Let me know if anything you need. Thanks for minding the flat, Jay.
I thought, someone needs to teach this man how to have a feeling and how to write a message. And they also need to tell me what the fuck I do now.
Chapter 37. August. August was too hot to walk outside. The day after I got Julian's message, I went alone to Pacific Place and walked a circuit past luxury outlets and American coffee shops. Outside Celine, I mussed my hair to look like a disheveled rich girl, then went in and tried on a white blazer. The shoulder pads held themselves up as though my own dimensions were immaterial. The sales girl seemed to feel that this also held for the rest of me. If I bought everything in the shop, then she would have to accept that I was important. And really, I could spend my whole life proving that. I could probably get Julian to marry me if I said it was to satirize men who had wives, and then it would only be a matter of not taking too much money at once. He would certainly let me have enough for everyone to think I mattered. 8 days till he returned. My savings account had more than enough for a deposit now. I could move tomorrow if I wanted. I had nothing to fear from Julian coming back. At worst, he'd kick me out and I'd return to a life where one room cost me half my paycheck. That was how most people lived. It was fine. On the ground floor, I caught sight of myself in a big Zara window. How can you be that pale, I thought, and not be sick? It was all ridiculous. I ordered a flat white at a marble-tiled cafe, sat down and drank it. The caffeine went through the appropriate channels. I thought, faster, please. At first it seemed unlikely I could harm Edith or Julian. They were rich and smart, and I dented fricatives for a living, badly. But the trouble was that the more I followed this logic, the less I could see why they had ever got involved with me. If they were mistaken enough about our relative status to let that happen, then it stood to reason that they might also, erroneously, be hurt that I'd been seeing someone else. My thoughts over coffee were always quite interesting. That evening, I had pot noodles and wine for dinner. I watched a zombie film on Netflix, liked a post of Edith's on Instagram, and read one of Miles's PDFs. Finally, I opened Julian's latest message.
We should have R&V for dinner when I'm back. Or take them out. Latter, prob best. Been in touch with V, and she says you've been ignoring her messages. All well? Not like you to not reply. Not like you to enjoy V's company either, but you need friends. Ask when they're free. Maybe a present for them. Just something from M&S and I'll say I got it in London. And get Miles something too. Don't write notes. I'll do that. Talk soon, Jay.
I decided to write one of my therapeutic drafts. I typed, I'm fucking Edith. I've told you who she is in previous fake messages, so I'm not sure if it's more consistent to pretend I'm sending this to the Julian who's read them, or if you're a new one now. It's all fake anyway. So, my girlfriend Edith and I are in love. She doesn't know about you. Also, it would not be ideal for me if you kicked me out of your apartment over this, so I don't know why I'm telling you.
You say you don't have feelings, but if you do, I'm sorry. I deleted it, went to the kitchen and drank more wine. The tap dripped. I'd meant to get it fixed, asked Julian who to call, remembered him sending me the landlord's number, but later couldn't find his message and didn't want to ask again for fear of seeming scatty. When I came back, I reopened my laptop and saw that rather than delete, I'd pressed send. I laughed. He didn't reply. At work, I took toilet breaks to check my inbox and weathered Joan's dirty looks. On the MTR, my data wavered, which forced me to go longer periods without refreshing. This made me think he surely would have messaged by the time it was my stop. But I'd climb up, get the signal back, and see he still hadn't. My throat felt tight and fraudulent. In that split, pre-literate second when I saw a new, bolded message, my pulse jumped from me. Then, TST tonight? Who's keen? In the teacher's group chat, and it settled. I'd think, I am not keen on TST tonight, or ever, and I could reply to that effect in all of 2 seconds, but I won't, because that would take effort, and I am currently funneling all available resources, physical, mental, human, into not publicly screaming at how fucked I am. Edith asked what was wrong. You like me lately, she said, checking and checking. I said if she did it, then surely I could too. You can do anything, she said, but I don't know why you'd want to be like me. I did want to be like her, but that also wasn't why I kept looking at my phone. I could have told her about Julian at that point, but then there would be consequences. Whereas if I put it off, then I would not have to deal with them yet. This reasoning seemed sensible to me, and I wondered why anyone ever volunteered information. 4 days later, Julian responded.
Hey, bit of a strange message, but I assume sent under the influence. It's fine. Not as if we're a thing, so do what you want. See you next week. Jay.
My abbreviation felt pointed. A implied both that he wasn't bothered typing 2 additional characters, and that the indefinite article was quite enough for me. I wanted to reply, I agree that I am the least definite of any article. Chapter 38. That weekend, I rang Tom. As we spoke, I stood on the balcony and watched children outrunning parents and put upon cynophiles being walked by their Great Danes. We talked about Tom first. Things had gone downhill with his latest paramour. This gave him an appetite to hear about my love life. I suspected because it made him grateful not to have one.
I can't believe you thought I hadn't guessed about Edith, he said.
Was it obvious?
So what did you think would happen?
You mean, what did I think would happen if I didn't tell her?
Yeah.
Well, broadly this, I said. Tom said,
I struggle to think of you as the older one sometimes.
I should tell her, I said. Tom said he wasn't going to tell me what to do, but that I should think about who I'd choose. I mightn't have to, but if one of them said that, I needed to know what I'd say. I told Tom I didn't know. I didn't want to weigh them up against each other.
All right, he said. Don't compare them. But how do you feel when you're with them? Or I mean, how do you act around them?
That question was less daunting. I'm not nice to Julian, I said. He doesn't love me, and I feel like that means there's something wrong with me. So then I want to believe the problem is actually him. We laugh a lot, but I'm a horrible person when I'm with him. I want to make him feel as bad as I do. It surprised me to learn that about myself, but there it was, out in the spitting air, echoed back to me thanks to the dodgy connection.
That's not good, said Tom, for either of you.
It's not. He's not over his ex. We shouldn't hold that against him.
And what about Edith? What do you like around her?
Kinder. More forgiving. And the sex is better.
I didn't need to know that.
Just giving you the facts.
Cool. Well, like I said, I can't tell you what to do. How long until he's back?
2 days now.
So one day to tell her?
I probably won't, I said.
That literally doesn't surprise me.
I know, but it was good talking it through. Thanks, Tom. I didn't tell him that often. I know it's not easy being straight with me.
It's not. You punish people for it.
I'd better go.
Sure.
Tom?
Yeah?
Thanks again. And thank Mam for me too.
You sound like you're off to the trenches.
I said, you're not wrong. Later that Sunday, Edith came over to the flat. We finally burned my Jo Malone candle. She had a red indent across her back where her bra dug in. I traced over the ridge and said I wondered what would happen if you wore a bra for 100 consecutive hours, as in, would you get a scar? It was my last day left to tell her about Julian before he got back, and I was asking her about skincare. My behavior was fascinating. Have you heard bras cause cancer? She said. It's probably quackery, but I worry. There's a lower breast cancer rate in countries where fewer women wear bras, but it's hard to establish the cause because not wearing a bra correlates with not doing stuff like eating junk food. I said, junk food causes cancer? We don't know what causes cancer, she said, beyond drinking and smoking. But you already know they're bad. Yes, I said, I do. Then, by the way, Julian's back next week. I was an idiot. I had no idea why I'd just said that. Probably it was that I'd told Tom I'd keep putting it off. Once I told someone I'd do something, I always did the opposite. Her hair was a thick black brush on my pillow. It occurred to me that most beds did not come with a particular Edith, that actually most people had no Edith at all, and that those people had to sleep in those beds or other relevant furniture and pretend to be happy. Is he? She said. I couldn't tell what she was thinking. I'm just after finding out, I said. And this thing, Edith said, pausing, not to decide what this thing meant, but so the break would be long enough that she didn't have to put words on it. This thing between you? It'll continue? What do you mean? You living with him? He's my flatmate, so... You don't pay rent, she said, in a just observing voice, like Julian's. It's complicated, I said. It's weird. Still seemingly just observing. You're into weird. Thanks for that, Ava, but I'm not sure this is the best time to tell me what I'm into. Look, I said, it's between me and him. Exactly, Edith said. She went out to the bathroom. I started to ask why she didn't just use the ensuite, but she was already gone. I only knew the pictures on the wall meant London because he'd told me. The middle one was Tudor-fronted with carceral grids for windows. Tall English buildings looked like tall English prisons, and when you said that to an English person, they thought you meant their prisons were lovely too. Edith came back. She stood in the doorway and held up a t-shirt she'd loaned me. I was about to say something, then saw she expected me to, and couldn't. Very quietly, she said, why was this in his room? What? I said. My t-shirt? It was on his bed? What were you doing in there? My question precisely. I can't believe you went into his room. Same. Edith, why the fuck were you in there? He's in London, I said. I was watching movies in his bed. Why were you watching movies in his bed? And Ava, please note that I'm a very intelligent person. She held herself perfectly as I told her everything, meeting my eye as though it was too late to keep me honest, but she could at least remind me I wasn't. All was still, her jaw, her hands. Whenever I paused, she nodded. I felt she controlled the taps and I would speak as long as she wanted and stop at a twist. Finally, she signaled she'd heard enough by coming and sitting at the edge of the bed. She folded the t-shirt in half, then quarters, then handed me it once she'd got it down to the smallest possible dimensions. You haven't told me how you feel about him, she said.
I thought I loved him, I said. Then I met you.
It's twisted as fuck that you're an actual kept woman, Edith said. And I do wish to give that its proper billing as the thing that would bother me if something else weren't bothering me more. But something else is bothering me more.
I wanted her to say it all. I wanted there to be nothing left and to have my deficiencies out where I could see them.
I can't tell what you feel for him, she said. Clearly he feels something, and I think you're desperate enough for his validation that you'll go back to him. I have many opinions about the nexus between monogamy and patriarchy, opinions which are available on request, should they interest you, but also, I feel like his views are probably quite conventional. So then we can't be together, if that happens.
While I was demonstrably not the world's leading Edith Whisperer, I sensed now was not the best time to tell her Julian already knew and had claimed to be fine with it.
Look, Edith, I said, I'm not the sort of person he'd have feelings for.
How do you mean? He's got money and he's smarter than me, and taller.
My understanding is that straight men like women to be smaller than them. Also, he doesn't want anything serious, and that's not me speculating, you've said it yourself. Then you come along and he just has to give you a room that he wasn't using. I know the type. You meet them in law firms. He doesn't want a woman in his league.
I said it was comforting to know he was only with me because I was short, boring, and plain.
I thought you said he wasn't with you, said Edith.
I told her she was right, and that I'd only said that for oratorical effect.
Whatever, she said. I didn't know till now how much I love you. But apparently it's enough to listen to your bullshit about oratorical effect, and he's taller than me, so how can he fancy me? And of course it's normal to have sex with two people in the same bed and not tell either of them.
It was always his bed, I said. I wanted to take her hand, but didn't dare. Mine was just you.
This logistical clarification assuaged her more than I thought it would. So will you keep fucking him when he gets back? Edith asked.
No,
I said. I realized when I heard it that it was a decision. You'll move out? She said.
Yeah.
But is it okay if I stay for a few weeks? Just until I find a place? She looked like she had something cold in her mouth that was hurting her teeth. Also, I said, you're wrong about Julian not being nice. He's nice. It says a lot about you that you think that proves you don't love him. I couldn't look at her. It was too accurate.
That's such a misogynist trope, I said. Women not liking nice guys.
Some people, Edith said, fit a great many misogynist tropes into their personal lives. Part 3. Edith and Julian. Chapter 39. September. We took the ferry to Lama Island. Edith wore a straw hat with a black band. Julian brought his laptop and tapped at emails. I sat in between and watched the foam curdling against the boat as it churned through the water.
She must be out of her mind,
Julian had said when I told him Edith wanted the three of us to do something together. You guys would get along.
She can't really want to meet me.
One of the stranger things about Julian, though, was that he'd say no to something, then come back later and say, no problem. I couldn't force an about-face, but could reasonably expect it if I made sure not to mention the issue in the interim.
Do you still think we should hang out with Edith?
He'd said in the kitchen a few days later.
At least I was still good at something.
First, we went walking. Edith held a parasol. There was a lot of greenery, scrunches of shops, and seafood restaurants with white plastic tables. Antiprandial fish swam their last in tight-packed tanks. I said, can we save one? Julian seemed to decide I was addressing him and said,
no.
Edith looked like she was speculating if this was a long-running joke between us. I wanted to tell her we'd never be that rude to her, but I really had no precedent to go by. We passed balconied houses spread out up the hill. He'd arrived 2 weeks ago at the start of September. The night before he'd returned, I'd thrown out Edith's edits, the flowers, the framed paper samples. I went to meet him at the airport, and when we got back, he took his shoes off in the hall and put them beside the heels I'd left earlier. I added the sandals I'd had on and saw that this combination, one pair of his and two of mine, looked a lot like something else. I made tea. "I've coffee either," I said. "We've coffee." Tea was fine, he said. The kettle clicked and hummed. I asked if I could stay until I found somewhere. For our llama lunch, Julian had made a booking at a raw vegan cafe. Even when he wasn't enthused by something, be it uncooked plant-based cuisine or Edith's company, he wanted to be in charge of it. She told him the restaurant was nice, and he looked at her pityingly, like she thought he'd built it by hand and he didn't want to disillusion her. I wondered if he'd thought Edith was vegan. It was the sort of thing he assumed about women. We ordered Sichuan dandan zucchini noodles and hot turmeric milk. The tables were tiny. We arranged our elbows carefully around the plates.
"Ava told me we're not allowed to talk about work," Julian said to Edith. "So I won't ask if you've advised my bank."
"I never said that," I told her. "Don't believe a word this one says about me." Edith said, "Julian, Ava mentioned you went to Oxford."
"For my sins, yes."
"I'm afraid I'm a tab."
"She told me,"
said Julian.
"Don't worry. Everyone makes bad choices."
I said, "Like the one Oxford made when they let you in."
"Does she do this to you, Edith?"
said Julian. "He loves it when I roast him about Oxford," I told her. "It reminds him he went there." After our raw lunch, we went walking again. Edith led. Her dress reminded me of hotel bedsheets, priest cotton, limb indented. Physically, I found it confusing to be around both of them. My face kept wanting to make expressions, something I now realized I censored it from doing when I was with Julian. I thought they'd had the same sense of humor, but now they were together, I couldn't think of a single joke they'd both like. Julian's phone rang when we were halfway back to the pier.
"You don't mind, do you?"
he said. I went ahead to walk with Edith. The Chinese banyans cast weeping shade. They grew figs. Edith had told me that before. I kept watching her, but couldn't do too much of it at once. "When are you moving out?" she said.
2 weeks,
I improvised. "You can stay with us. Mrs. Zhang could improve you. Everyone she meets, she sees room for improvement." We'd reached the shops. In Central, the signs blocked the skyline like pop-ups, 10 per lamppost, one per story of a 20-floor building. But on Llama, there were gaps between them. Awnings shaded the walk. A shop with sliding doors and no English name stocked postcards and dried meat. The morning before this outing, the sun had woken me early. I got water and paced while drinking it in the lounge. I caught up an apple and did not eat it, and observed red-lined heels beside Julian's shoes in the hall, but did not care. Throughout inspecting the shoes, I continued not caring, and on seeing they were a 7, formed no dubiously feminist mental image of her big ugly feet. Then I went to my room and cried, which was sometimes something people did. And as I was crying, I heard Victoria say she'd best be off. "It's hard moving out," I told Edith. "Practically, you mean?" she said. I said, "I love you." I loved her that moment, yes. But also because the morning I heard Victoria leave, I'd put on a cardigan Edith had thrown on the floor. Like Edith, it smelled of soap. I remembered how she listened whenever I told her about Irish. And then I thought about the places where things lived in her bag. I was one such thing now. I was safe there, and no one but Edith could hurt me. So that when Julian asked later that day if we were still on for Llama tomorrow, I'd said, "All good," and meant it. Edith stopped to take a picture of the two of us. I asked if it was for Instagram, and she said no, it was just to have. I could see her browsing filters. As usual, I felt excited to feature on her feed, but anxious that I would look mismatched with everything else there. I knew her caption would remind the people she was out to that I was her girlfriend, but wouldn't give it away to anyone else. That was more than I ever did to advertise our relationship. The pier was just ahead of us now. We saw the next ferry was due in 10 minutes. Having finished his phone call, Julian caught up. Edith asked if either of us wanted chewing gum or water, and when we said no, she went to get some for herself. "That was fun," I said to Julian once she'd left. "I thought you guys got on well." He'd started on a cigarette and gestured at the packet to offer me one. "I don't smoke," I said, "remember?"
"Sorry,"
he said. We could see the ferry coming in now, chugging and ripple-making. The sky bled yellow into blue. It was early for a sunset. I told Julian this and he nodded. Then he cleared his throat.
"I'd better tell you before she gets back," he said.
I followed his gaze and saw Edith leaving the shop. "Tell me what?" I said.
"They rang just now. Sorry, just let me."
He stubbed out his cigarette and lit another. "What's happened, Julian?" He exhaled.
"My dad's had a heart attack."
Chapter 40. Julian said they were properly referred to as acute myocardial infarctions. At first, he'd thought the textbook had misspelled infractions, but it was a different word. Infarctions. The first hour after it happened, it, meaning an acute myocardial infarction, was crucial in determining the outcome. The outcome, Julian referred to, was binary in nature.
"He has coronary artery disease," Julian said. 63 is young for it. The doctors say it's the booze and fags. That or genetic predisposition."
Julian lit a cigarette, then appeared to remember what he'd said about the factors that had compromised Miles' arteries. It didn't stop him smoking, but he was quiet. When he'd finished, we went back into the hospital. I gestured towards the lift, but he wanted us to take the stairs.
"You're both making a tremendous fuss," Miles said. "I lived through Thatcher."
Julian buttoned and unbuttoned his shirt sleeves.
"I phoned Mum,"
he said.
"She's getting the next flight."
"It's kind of her to come and support you," said Miles.
"Dad,
aren't you needed at work?"
"They can live without me for a day."
"Goodness, you really must think I'm nearing expiry."
That night in the sitting room, I saw Julian watch a video on his laptop. It showed a heart like a rubbery boxing glove. A black patch spread from one of the arteries. Then came the plaque buildup, artistically realized as yellow bumps. Julian learnt that Miles should have chewed an aspirin. It would have lowered the risk of a blood clot. I said, "Maybe you can tell him now."
"Thanks for the input,"
said Julian.
"But I'm not sure I want to give my father advice for the next time his heart stops working. Not exactly blue sky thinking, is it?"
A few days later, the last of Miles's tests came back. Julian found them reassuring enough to go back to work. But his habits got weirder and more erratic. When he was hungry enough to remember about food, he'd have whatever required the fewest steps. Dry cereal, bagel not even cut in two. Small things irked him.
"Why did you put my phone on the couch?"
he said. I said, "I thought it was mine until the screen came on."
"You should have put it back. I might have got a call."
"You would have heard it ringing."
"No, I wouldn't. It's in silent mode from the hospital. Why can't you leave things where you found them?"
Later he apologized. I told him he could be as cross with me as he wanted, and he replied,
"Don't say that. I need you to be normal."
"I don't want to upset you," I said. He said,
"If I ever say the words, 'it upsets me,' please have me shot."
Florence arrived 3 days after Miles was hospitalized. She stayed 4 nights. She knew Julian had a 2-bedroom flat and didn't know I was living there. but he got her a hotel room on the pretext that he worked late and wouldn't want to wake her. Miles could only have two visitors at a time, so I never met Florence. Julian said this was for the best. She didn't take to other women. I asked if he meant their being in his life or their existence full stop. He didn't respond. After a few weeks, they released Miles with a full complement of medicine and a list of substances that could and couldn't enter his body. We visited him at his home. I asked Julian if he'd prefer to go alone, and he said absolutely not. I don't even say anything, I said. I sit there and watch you guys talk.
You keep us civil. He hasn't held me personally responsible for the global financial crisis even once since you came into our lives, and I've stopped comparing him to Stalin.
I acknowledged this was a benefit not to be discounted. Mam said Grand-Aunt Maggie needed a hip replacement. Again, Mam said. Maggie had a turbulent relationship with prosthetics. The first fake hip had damaged some of the remaining portion of Maggie's actual pelvis, so now she was getting another, and probably suing. You never knew with the solicitors. I said my friend Edith did law, albeit in another jurisdiction, and offered to ask her about it. Mam said she sounded like a nice girl. This other friend of mine is having a hard time, I said. His dad's just out of hospital. It felt indiscreet to say the friend was the banker. The poor lad, said Mam. This was likely the first time anyone had ever referred to Julian as a lad. Would it be serious? Well, he's grand now. He had a heart attack, but he's in remission.
God love him.
Both of them, I said.
Sure look.
Mam's dad died when I was 6. Like any number of men in our family, he'd been an alcoholic. You had to be careful of that, Mam said. I couldn't tell if she meant men should be careful of drink, or we should be careful of them. The funeral was in the big white turf-smelling house in Roscommon. I'd gone back twice a year since to see Nana, who lasted 8 years more. George and Tom watched telly with her, and I'd go to the sink to wash up.
You're as good,
Nana said.
Bit of initiative.
At college, I had tentatively described this as an example of patriarchal conditioning. But in fact, I'd felt superior doing jobs while the boys sat there like spuds. I asked Mam what to do about Julian.
You're as well not prying, Mam said. Just be there for him.
She put me on to Dad. He said,
Grand stretch in the evenings now.
And I said there was. He said it was well for some. It is, I said. I felt important because now I was the one who couldn't see Edith. She messaged asking to hang out, and I said I was busy. I meant that I wanted to be there for Julian when he got home, but I obviously couldn't tell her that. So she probably thought I was dynamic and sought after in ways I was too busy to even explain to her. That, or she thought I needed to manage my time better. After Miles had been in hospital for a week, Julian took me to the Marriott in Admiralty. It was the first time we'd been out together properly since his return earlier in September. In the elevator, a mink-coated woman scanned his height, as though unsure he needed so much of it. Then my hemline, in certainty that a great deal more was required. He let me order for both of us and said, distractedly, that my hair looked quite nice. We discussed whether the word quite magnified or diminished a compliment. I sketched a Klein on a napkin and put quite between a little and very. It was nice being someone else's Edith. Julian drew his own and put it between very and extremely. In this context, he said. In others, I was quite right. I asked which quite he'd used just there, and he said he wondered how he'd managed to miss me in London. I missed you too, I said. He said I'd been a good friend to him. I want to be now, I said. The seats were upholstered in a range of fabrics, overlooked by paintings of cliffs. The women in the restaurant wore bright dresses as though to atone for the glum-suited men. We had to have him along, you see. Julian and I started inventing stories for the ones nearby. He took as married a couple I regarded as quite obviously having a secret liaison.
At the Marriott, Julian said.
I said, sorry, I forgot everyone occupies a social realm where they're bound to see someone they know at a 5-star hotel. I felt calm in a way I never had before he'd left. I had Edith to go on real dates with now, so I didn't need to worry about whether Julian and I were on one. We could just eat. He told me London had changed, not for everyone, of course, but for him. Nothing but the Shard was tall anymore. The Tube was shabbier than before. At least in both countries, the woman in the announcements was equally anxious that he please make way for alighting passengers. He wondered if she minded hearing her voice in stations. There was no amount of money he would accept to have his own broadcast to him when he was trying not to spill coffee on himself. He'd thought he didn't notice the Chinese characters everywhere in Hong Kong, but found in London that the signs looked bare without them, though his Chinese reading comprehension was still, he said, below that of literally a toddler. And he took the opposite view to Middle England's regarding London. He was freaked out by how many white people there were. Keep a wide berth of Oxford, so, I said. Afterwards, we took the tram from Admiralty to Pottinger Street, then the outdoor escalator. Signs, as always. Sunny Palm Sauna. Paris Hair Salon. Open late, sex, toy shop. Emphasis theirs. It seemed humorous that Julian could be standing to the right, looking like the rest of us, when we had stayed while he was gone. I realized I walked ahead of him now. The first time he took me to lunch, he'd reached the MTR station escalator first, then let me go ahead, so, I soon saw, the height difference wouldn't be magnified on the steps. It had made me nervous. If he thought of things like that, I'd wondered what other observations he'd make. Now, 23 was shaping up to be the first year of my life where the idea of someone noticing me didn't fill me with abject horror. I supposed later was better than never. Inside the flat, I made chamomile tea. I said, I know you probably don't want to talk about Miles, but I'm there if you do.
Thanks, Ava,
Julian said. We sat on the couch and watched the news on his laptop. He said he was thinking of getting a real physical TV. I said, Christ, you really are pushing 30. Hong Kong's government had jailed 3 prominent pro-democracy student leaders. British McDonald's workers were striking over zero-hour contracts. How can you agree with me so much and not like Corbyn?
I think really the difference stems from our feelings on whether it would be in the national interest to turn Britain into a gulag.
Julian fiddled with his shirt sleeves and said,
Do we have a date for moving out?
Maybe in a couple of weeks.
Right.
I drank some of my tea so I could go and top up the water. If that's okay, I said.
Well,
Julian said,
that's not much time to find somewhere.
Places move quick here, I said, and I could get an Airbnb if I had to.
True. Well, just so you know, there's no rush at my end if you need longer.
Then he got up and looked for his MacBook charger. He should really just buy another, he said. Buy one for each socket in the flat. Still probably managed to lose them all. I'm sorry about the message, I said. I directed this comment to the cushion I was holding. It was an accident.
These things happen,
he said, as though people routinely sent him rambling declarations of who they were fucking. This was not outside possibility. His friends were pretty weird. So, Victoria, I said. I didn't know if she'd been back since, but I hadn't noticed if she had.
How did you...
I'm a very intelligent person.
You don't mind?
No, I said. I did, but if I've got someone... He laughed.
I hope no one holds me to my mistakes as much as all that.
It had never made sense to me that men thought women they'd had sex with would like to hear them be unkind about other women they'd had sex with. You would have to be a raging egomaniac, I thought, to think those men didn't also speak about you that way. The worst thing Julian had ever said about Kat was that she was fine, and that was one of the reasons I trusted him. It wasn't my business to mind that he was now doing and saying things he wouldn't have previously, but it worried me. I went to the window so he wouldn't have to look at me and said, "Do you want me to stay until Miles is better?"
"The doctor said he'll be fine in a few weeks," Julian said.
With my fingers, I brushed stray soil from a potted plant off the windowsill, then went to the bin and dusted it off my hands. The plant was a gift from Edith. She'd said I couldn't really feel safe living where nothing grew. "I can stay," I said, "if it would help." I expected him to say, "if you like," and that I'd need a good half hour to determine whether he could do without me. Women took care of men and let them pretend we didn't. I knew it was unfair to compare Julian to someone whose entire schooling hadn't told him crying was for women and poors, but I remembered Edith thanking me for how I'd handled Mrs. Zhang.
"Why are we drinking tea?" Julian said. "Let's have Pinot Noir."
"De Chambertin or de Clos de Vougeot?"
"That's not my accent."
"Okay, but which?"
"Wait, fuck. We still have the Clos de Vougeot?"
I saw him think, and she had us drinking tea. My hand slipped when I poured, so I filled his glass nearly to the top. I started saying sorry, and Julian said there was nothing in the world less worthy of apology. I said he looked good, and he said that was surprising, because the air pollution app I'd shown him had been as negative about London as it was about Hong Kong. I'd deleted it myself long ago. He said that was classic us. He had a point, though I couldn't decide what it was.
"Don't feel obliged," Julian said, "but I would appreciate it if you stayed."
"I will," I said. "I'm happy to."
"As friends. Till I know he's all right."
Friends could mean anything. Chapter 41. October. It was October the 1st. National Day. Julian and I offered to spend it with Miles, but he laughed and said he had other plans already. Edith suggested we see the fireworks at Victoria Harbour. I wasn't sure what she was up to, asking Julian along too, but didn't probe her on it. He agreed to come. Walking through the crowd, I thought of the conclusions people would draw from seeing us. A tall, fair man and two small, dark-haired women. Two whites, one Asian. We couldn't be related, but we were too different to be an obvious friend circle. Edith's clothes looked the most expensive, so perhaps we were her harried personal assistants. But why were we spending National Day together? Possibly Julian and I were Edith's friends from uni and had flown over from London for the week. We'd all gone to the same Oxford college, and Julian and I were married and visiting Edith following her return to Hong Kong, so she could help us dip into the culture. Could you spot a gay woman on sight? It was meant to be one of the superpowers attendant on liking women, but clearly I'd never had it. Edith found a vantage point and told Julian to use his height to make space for us.
"This is fantastic, isn't it?"
he said without raising his intonation.
"A nice day out with my best girls."
Edith shushed him and he laughed.
"What?"
he said.
"Are you worried you won't hear the fireworks over me?"
I stood in the middle. Every time a firework burst, I squeezed Edith's hand. Julian craned his head forward like he wanted to appear more attentive than he was. He was conscious, I knew, that this wasn't a public holiday in London and that clients would expect responses within an hour. That was Edith's situation as well. But she'd done more on her phone on the way over, so her hourly window ended later. I wondered at first which thoughts they expelled to make room for such considerations. But this was unscientific. Actually, the brain grew new cells the more information you fed it. I didn't like that and was sorry I'd thought of it, because it meant they were getting smarter than me every day. The billboards above us cracked out red, white and gold. Kids shouted,
and I wondered if there were sounds they couldn't pronounce yet in Cantonese. Afterwards, I walked Edith to Sai Ying Pun Station. There was a mural inside of people disenchanted with urban life. She said she'd had a nice time and liked Julian. Then she asked if there'd been any developments with finding a flat. I'm thinking mid-October, I said. You were thinking the end of September the last time I asked. His dad's had a heart attack. I know you want to be a good friend, said Edith, but I don't think he'd ask this of any of his other friends. That's because his other friends are actual sociopaths. Still, just a few more weeks. If you're sure, she said. We hugged, and she went through the turnstile. I stayed until she was out of sight to see if she'd look back, but she didn't. Proper school had started again for my students, though they'd continued coming to my classes all summer. The 7-year-olds were halfway through their module on sentence-level grammar now. A few days after the fireworks, I gave them a lesson on category nouns versus exact nouns. I hadn't heard of this distinction prior to opening the textbook. It transpired that a category noun was something like vegetables, whereas exact nouns were beetroot, carrots, broccoli. It was better to use exact nouns because this made your writing more precise and interesting. The chapter gave a short explanation, followed by an exercise. An A4 page divided into columns. On the left were various category nouns. On the right, you had to fill in at least 3 corresponding exact nouns. I told the kids they could use their Cantonese to English dictionaries. Cynthia Mack asked what to say for people. Did it mean sister, brother, father, or teacher, doctor, artist, or they're all okay? I said. But if I put sister, father, brother in people, then what about here? She pointed to the box marked family. Okay, don't do those. Do teacher or something. But what about here? Signaling the professions row. Okay, something else for people. Happy people? Sad people? Happy people isn't an exact noun. It's an adjective plus a category noun. So, what should I write? We looked at each other. It was indeed a challenge to describe people in a way not immediately related to how they earned money or their position in the family unit. I said, how about friend, boyfriend, colleague? I don't want to write boyfriend. I couldn't blame her for questioning the exercise. Friend, enemy, and colleague didn't seem like ways of narrowing down person in the way apple did for fruit. An apple would still be a fruit if it didn't have any others in its vicinity, but you couldn't be someone's nemesis without their hanging around to complete the definition. The same issue cropped up with my earlier suggestions. Family was relational, and profession was created and given meaning by external structures. Admittedly, adult, child, and teenager could stand on their own, but I still found it depressing that the way we specified ourselves, the way we made ourselves precise and interesting, was by pinpointing our developmental stage and likely distance from mortality. Fruit didn't have that problem. Even a British man, so very British and so very male as Julian, surely had limits as to what he could pretend not to notice, on grounds auditory if not emotional. So Edith and I had been meeting in love hotels since his return a few weeks ago. The first one was on Lockhart Road in Wan Chai. She told me it was an hourly rental, which augured something tawdry. But it was upholstered and managed like any other budget joint. He just had to check out sooner. The sheets smelled clean, probably because they'd been sprayed to. We booked the whole evening so we could watch TV afterwards. I wish we could tell people, I said in an ad break. I like having a secret, Edith said. Would you like me if it wasn't a secret? I don't know. We could try telling people and see if I'm still interested. Who should we tell? My family aren't ready, she said. I told Cyril and Tony about us. People from Cambridge know I'm a lesbian, but I don't think anyone else does. I suspect I'd be rumbled if I introduced them to my girlfriend.
She said things in that formal way when she was trying to be droll. It irked me sometimes, but I knew it was her way of coping with things. So, who else is there? I said. Julian, I guess.
But he already knows.
It's a pity, said Edith. It would have been so good if we'd told him together. He'd have been all, I'm so happy for you guys. I'm touched you being open with me. Isn't it great that we're sharing our feelings?
That's a perfect Julian impression. I thought you actually were him for a second there. She didn't get that I was joking, or at any rate didn't laugh, so I added, But I mean, you can tell him. Just maybe don't expect much of a reaction.
She wasn't looking at me. I couldn't tell if this was deliberate, but I didn't want to check her face, because if I did and she didn't look back, then I'd know she was doing it on purpose. She said, Do you think we'll ever tell people?
I wouldn't mind, I said.
Telling people or not?
Either. It's up to you.
But I want it to be up to you, Edith said. Then she laughed slightly. I felt this had a more credible softening effect when people did it by text.
We don't need to talk about it right now, I said.
That's such a Julian thing to say.
What's he got to do with us? I said.
We'll talk about it later. And then you never do.
I don't think I've ever told you that.
What? Said Edith. Do you think I've bugged your apartment?
I genuinely don't remember telling you that.
Well, you did. You can believe me or not. And not to pester you, but I'm working on it. You'd better be.
Chapter 42. The third week of October, Edith said we should do something socially productive. Julian brought the plastic bags. We walked along the beach and picked up rubbish. Julian complained that there was no point because if we came back tomorrow, people would have dumped more packaging on the shore. Edith asked if he'd heard the parable about the man flinging starfish into the sea. Julian said yes, and that he thought it was nonsense because the man should have tried to get to the root of the starfish crisis instead of sticking plasters on it. She asked if he meant by seizing the means of production, and his face said, Why is it that everyone I know is a white-collar slave, a deranged Bolshevik, or in this case, both? We kept going till the shore was litter-free, then tied the bags and disposed of them. Julian said the recycling bins were just for show, and it would all go to landfill, where it would probably do more damage than if we'd left it on the sand. Edith replied that if he had a better idea for how to spend the next socially productive Saturday, then he was welcome to plan our next tripartite field trip. He asked if she was quite sure there had to be a next one. I left them to it. I had other things to think about. They squabbled again about where to eat. Edith suggested a pizza place. Julian said London was cheaper and better for that sort of thing. Edith said we weren't in London, so she didn't see the relevance at that point. We wound up going for seafood at the boathouse on Stanley Main Street, which neither of them had wanted, but which gave each the satisfaction of knowing that the other hadn't got their choice. The terrace overlooked the bay. Edith and Julian ordered a platter of crayfish, clams and scallops. They struggled to fit it beside the fake peonies on the table. I got mushroom soup and didn't eat it. The boathouse waitress brought our bill. I asked Edith if there was a Cantonese phrase meaning lie of omission. She said she couldn't think of a direct translation off the top of her head, but that there used to be a TV thriller series called Lives of Omission about the Hong Kong police force. It starred Michael Che. They cancelled it after 30 episodes. Julian said,
Where do you find the time to watch so much shit TV?
I did most of my watching as a student, Edith said, and it's actually quite good. It got loads of TVB nominations.
What are they?
Never mind. They seemed cordial, but they always did. I wondered what they were really thinking, and knew that in Edith's case at least, those thoughts were probably hostile. I wished she could understand that Julian wasn't pulling me back into our old dynamic. Him needing me was strange and new. Also, his father had been ill. It seemed farcical that I even needed to explain to Edith why I couldn't abandon him now. On another level,
I knew I'd abused her trust and had broken it again since my first apology by staying with Julian past the initial deadline. Under this reading of events, which I did appreciate was probably the sane one, it was not much to ask that I stop living with the man I'd lied to her about fucking. But what sort of person packed their bags when their friend's dad was just out of hospital? This, I thought, was the trouble with being emotionally invested in two articulate people who both made their case well. Julian hadn't exactly, but I made it to myself with the sort of analysis he would use.
What about you, Ava?
Said Julian. He's asking what you think of Martin Schulz, Edith said. The leader of the German Social Democrats? Julian likes him. I don't. Then I don't either, I said, and Julian congratulated Edith on having such a loyal stooge. It had been sunny when we entered the restaurant, but when we left, the hail shot down as though from a volley gun. We had one cheap umbrella, which looked wholly unequal to the task before it. They said I should hold it. Being the modal height, I'd keep it at the fairest altitude for the three of us. Chapter 43. Edith and I went to a bookstore cafe on Park Road in late October, the week after the beach trip. It had a red door and wicker ceiling lampshades. I brought over coffee and muffins, and Edith read aloud from an article in the Scientific American. A recent study suggests that our ability to construct sentences may arise from procedural memory, she quoted. The same simple memory system that lets our dogs learn to sit on command. Procedural memory stored skills like swimming and riding a bicycle, while declarative memory was for facts and memories. You formed phrases by mirroring patterns from sentences you'd heard in the past. That was why Edith said, "Do you have it?" Where I might say, "Have ye it on ye?" We'd grown up hearing different versions of English. Consciously or otherwise, we reproduced them. But I don't say, "Have ye it on you?" I said. I say what you say. And you didn't grow up hearing British English. You said your accent was American until you went to boarding school. It's an example, Ava. I was picking holes to keep Edith talking, but really I found the whole thing comforting. I was less responsible for what I said if I'd soaked it up from other people. If someone said something to hurt me, it wasn't because they meant to, but because they'd surrounded themselves with unkind people in the past. And if I wanted to be someone who dashed off barbed retorts and didn't betray investment in those around them, I just had to listen to the people I wanted to imitate. My brain would rattle off their sentences. But it's depressing, I said, again, mostly to hear Edith's response. Our words don't mean anything. I don't think the selection of the content is procedural, just how we use grammar to express it. Then she went to buy a book. She put it in the middle section of her bag when she got back. Her manner made it clear that she expected me to raise what we'd been avoiding. I'm worried about him, I said. We drink wine and he tells me things. I don't think he has anyone else to talk to. What sort of things does he tell you? He believes in God. Is it quite necessary for you to live with him so you can have theological debates? We don't debate it, I said. Her face was impassive, so I kept mine that way too. I don't really care. I don't feel that's quite as compelling a counterpoint as you think it is. Calmly. Edith, you're being such a lawyer. I'd intended this to sound playful. It did not. Ava, you're being indecisive. She was still calm, and I hated her for being able to keep it up longer than I could. Probably Edith did not feel things as strongly as I did. She was at an unfair advantage. Or she experienced the same intensity of emotion as I did, but her feelings were normal and appropriate, whereas mine were sick and misdirected. I'm not being indecisive, I said.